You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Hello and welcome to all of you here in New York and also joining us by video in D.C. I'm Mark Schuffs and I'm an Open Society Fellow. Today I am thrilled to have Tracy Mears talk with us about a more effective and a more humane method of policing violent crime. Every year, 16,000 Americans are murdered. That is more than five 9/11 attacks every year, year after year. And this violence is not distributed evenly in our society. It is concentrated in neighborhoods that are primarily urban, poor, and black or Hispanic. Among young men of color living in high crime neighborhoods, the risk of being murdered is 65 times. The national average, 65 times the national average. That is obscene and unacceptable. Unfortunately, the way many police departments have attempted to police these neighborhoods has all too often increased tensions between the police and the community, especially communities of color. Police frequently sweep through a community, arresting dozens of young men for what I call BWB, or being while black, or being while brown. These almost indiscriminate sweeps contribute to another fact about our society, which is obscene and unacceptable, and that's our bloated rate of incarceration. As you all know, we incarcerate a larger proportion of our population than any country for which there are statistics, even Russia and China. Often, our policing tactics are ineffective and can be challenged on those grounds. But sometimes, these abrasive, racially tinged methods do seem to have effectiveness. Here in New York, the murder rate has been reduced to historic lows, but at what cost? Every year, the NYPD subjects more than 500,000 citizens to stop and frisk searches, and almost 90% of the people they stop are non-white. Some folks at OSI have had the opportunity to listen to the stories of some of the young men, it's mostly men, who are stopped and frisked, and the humiliation and rage that they feel will last for years. Clearly, violent crime and the way we police violent crime are two of the biggest problems facing urban minority communities. So, is there a better way? Is there a way to lower the rate of violent crime, reduce the number of people we send to prison, and improve, or at least not worsen, race relations? Our guest today, Tracy Mears, has an answer. Tracy is currently a professor at Yale Law School. Before coming to Yale, she was a law professor at the University of Chicago. What I find most valuable about her work is that it combines academic research and theory with real-world experience. In academic studies of crime, many researchers ask what makes people break the law. Tracy's academic work turns that question on its head. She asks, what makes people obey the law? Her answer is simple but profound. People are more likely to obey laws when they consider and believe that those laws are legitimate. Tracy has unpacked what it actually means when people see laws as legitimate. What are the components of legitimacy? And she'll share some of what she's learned with us today. As a real-world innovator, Tracy has put her academic theories into practice in one of the toughest cities in America, Chicago. She is the principal investigator on an intervention, which she will describe, that helped slash the homicide rate in two crime-ridden Chicago neighborhoods by more than a third. The intervention also reduced the number of people who went back to prison by about a third. And it did so in a way that enhanced rather than undermined respect for the law. In other words, Tracy's intervention reinforced the law's legitimacy. Perhaps the most encouraging thing about Tracy's Chicago intervention is that it is not a fluke. Tracy and myself are board members of a new organization called the National Network for Safe Communities, which seeks to change the way this country polices gun crime and open-air drug markets. The National Network is chaired by two people who work just down the street from us at John Jay College, Jeremy Travis and David Kennedy. Their efforts and Tracy's operate from similar core principles and have had similar effects. Today's cities that use these programs or the principles that inform these programs are about to be started or are already active in 75 cities around the country, including Chicago, Cincinnati, Providence, Milwaukee, and as of last month, Los Angeles, under the leadership of probably America's most influential police chief, Bill Bratton. As Tracy's experience in Chicago shows, and as the experience of these cities hammers home, we can reduce violent crime, lower the number of people we send to prison, and improve community police relations. It is not pie in the sky. That's why I believe the National Network is one of the most important initiatives in criminal justice in America today, and it's also why I'm thrilled to have Tracy here to share her work and her insights. It is an honor and a pleasure to welcome Tracy Mears to the Open Society Institute.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I should be clapping for that person, too. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really an honor to be here. OSI does such amazing work, and I'm really pleased and honored to be asked to come and share some of mine with you. Mark told me I had about 15 minutes to talk before we get into the question and answer, and I'm sure that what we really want to talk about are the principles that Mark mentioned that support legitimacy. What I'd like to do is spend probably about the 15 minutes just running through the Chicago work so you can see the numbers, what we did, what I think is going on, and then probably explore the answers as to why in the question and answer, because if you wanted me to do all of that, it would really be probably about a 40-minute talk, and we don't have that now. Okay, so here we go. Policing Gun Crime Without Guns is actually the title of a paper that I can give you a link to after the talk if you are interested. Let me start by talking about what this is. Hood Switch, many of you I'm sure have heard about. It's a federally funded program to bring multi-jurisdictional task force together to deal with gun crime. And the Bush administration spent about $1 billion on it. We got a good chunk of that money, we being Chicago. And one of the most unique aspects of Project Safe Neighborhoods was that each federal district that received the money had to designate a researcher in order to have evidence-based practices put into play. That is, whatever strategy was implemented, it was supposed to be implemented in a way in which it could be measured. And the slide you see up there right now tells you who the task force in Chicago includes. And our goal was to reduce homicides by going after the guns and gun offenders, especially gang members. So now what that was about was Pat Fitzgerald really wanted to prosecute convicted felons. The idea being that people who are released from prison shouldn't have a gun or ammunition. And he wanted to take a page out of the Richmond Strategy Project Exile. I had a conversation with him and said, why would you think that would work exactly? And he said, I think that offenders are afraid of federal imprisonment. The problem, of course, with that is that federal prosecution and imprisonment is incredibly rare in contrast to the more typical state and county level strategies. There's no particular reason for anyone to think that the typical offender was aware of what the feds were doing. So what we tried to do was come up with a strategy to inform them about what was going on, which I'll tell you about in a second. The picture you see now is gives you a sense of the landscape in Chicago. The red squares tell you where the guns are. The redder the square, the more guns there are. The green dots are where there are homicides. So you can see that guns and homicides are clustered in two areas in Chicago. The top left is the west side of Chicago, the bottom right, the south side of Chicago. Those are our two areas of concern. It's another slide that shows you what the crime rate looks like. When we started the work in Chicago, the top left circle that you saw, the west side of Chicago, had a homicide rate of about 75 per 100,000. To put that in perspective, the homicide rate in New York today, I believe, is about 6 per 100,000. Okay, what did we do? So the first one is the more federal gun prosecutions. That was Pat Fitzgerald's strategy. And the idea was that it would be effective because federal prison sentences were longer and also were typically served farther away from home than were the county and state sentences. This was supposed to be a deterrent to people. We also thought about getting more guns off of the street. That is, if you get the guns off the street, that people would not have available to them the most lethal technology. They would have to use something that's less lethal, like a knife. Following Jeff Canada's work, fist, stick, knife, gun, all other things being equal, we want people to go for the knife, then the stick, and maybe the fist. The last strategy was the one that I really pressed Pat on, and these are the offender notification meetings. The idea here is that there's no reason to think, as I said, that the folks who were released from prison had any idea what the feds were doing. So we wanted to take a page out of the Boston ceasefire playbook. I don't know if you are familiar with Boston, but there what they did was this was David Kennedy, brought together groups of youths who were fighting with each other, brought them into a room and told them, look, if you don't stop fighting, you don't stop shooting each other, we are going to bring all of our capacity to bear on you and all of our law enforcement strategies to bear to get you to stop killing each other because it's not acceptable. Now, at the end of the day, this was in the 90s, you may have heard that Boston experienced the Boston Miracle. There was not one juvenile homicide in Boston for, I believe, about 2.5 years. And many people credit this strategy that that I've just described. We did something a little different. What we did was try to address the fact that not only that giving people information would make them, hopefully, more likely to desist from crime. That's the deterrent strategy. Excuse me, I have really bad allergies past couple days, but also the normative change idea. And that is that if you want people to obey the law, you have to give them a reason to obey the law, and you have to couch the strategy in ways that encourages them to recognize that the law is valid and ought to be deferred to. So what we did was come up with offender notification meetings in which people who were recently released from prison would go to a meeting. They would come to a room in a place of civic importance that is not a law enforcement location. It was not a police station, not a court. It was places in like park buildings, community colleges. A couple of times we did them in a sort of community hospital. And at this meeting, the offenders recently released from prison would sit around a table much like this one. It was a round table setting where they would receive three messages. The first message was a law enforcement message, and that was delivered by a combination of federal prosecutors, state prosecutors, the police commander of the relevant district, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And that message was simple. You're a convicted felon, you can't have a gun, and if you have a gun, then we will prosecute you because the violence on the street must stop. And it's we expect you to play a role in stopping that violence. That takes about 15 minutes. The second speaker was an ex-offender who had changed his life around, usually his. I don't think we've ever had any women. And the person was much more evocative and emotional. His message to the men was, I've changed my life, and you can too. Here's what it takes. Your community needs you. Your community needs you to stop engaging in violence, but your community also needs you to step up and play a role and be part of the solution and not the problem. In the last section of the meeting, there are service providers from the offender's own neighborhood, typically people offering GED services, drug treatment, work training, and the like. And those folks' message to the offenders is, we're here to help. Again, you have a choice. It's up to you. You can either be part of the solution or part of the problem. We want to give you every opportunity to be part of the solution. Come talk to us. The entire thing takes about an hour. What happens? Well, after implementing this strategy, one of the things you see is that in the 11th and 15th police districts, this is the one, if you're remembering the picture, on the top and left, that's the west side of Chicago, the crime rate is going down. Now, I'm going to anticipate a question. Yes, crime was already going down, but our analysis suggests that after Project Safe Neighborhood strategies were instituted, the crime rate went down at a much faster rate than it did in the areas in which the strategy was not implemented. So 7 and 9, you'll see it's going down slightly. In 7 and 9, that's the green line. What PSN was instituted about a year and a half later, and then we start getting a quicker drop there, too. The other interesting thing about this is once you take out 11 and 15 and 7 and 9, you see that the homicide rate in the rest of the city has basically been flat for quite a long time. So the crime rate in Chicago is being driven by these two areas primarily. This is just a nicer, smoother graph so that you can see where the effects of the strategy are heading. What's working? Okay. Remember, there are a few different strategies. There are the forums. There are the prosecutions. There are the gun seizures, that's the ATF seizures, and what we're calling an index of interventions. We figured out a way to measure the additive effect of those three strategies. All four of those things were having a pretty big effect. We found no effect at all of sentence length on homicides. This next slide shows you the range, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about why, and then we can get into some questions. Okay. Now, what you see here is a measurement of the impact of each percentage increase of the strategy. So for gun recoveries, for example, each gun you get off the street is worth negative 2.2. I won't say exactly what it is, but it's just so you can see they're all comparable. They're measured in a way that's comparable. What the gun recovery measure means is if you get 100 guns off the street, in Chicago, you save a life. Each gun off the street is worth about the same as one federal prosecution. That's what you see there. And the forum measure we find the most interesting. Now, the way to understand that is we measured that by the percentage increase in the number of people who were eligible to attend a forum who actually went, right? So as people are released from prison, you are eligible to attend the forum if you have a gun crime in your history or a violent crime in your history. So that's the pool of people coming out. And then as each person goes to the forum, then that's they go out of the pool. And then as more people come in to the community, the pool increases, so on and so forth. And what you see here is that a 1% increase in attendance is worth a lot. Okay. Now, why do we think that's happening? Here's what I think. I think a lot of this has to do with legitimacy. As I said before, we paid a lot of attention to the architecture of the meeting and also the substance of the meeting. The architecture was designed to be egalitarian in nature. That is, there's not a podium where there are speakers and an audience, but instead a roundtable format where each person who is speaking can make eye contact with each person sitting around the table. There's no hierarchy, and that's deliberate. The meetings were set in a place that are not associated at all with law enforcement. Again, that was deliberate. We chose places of civic importance to emphasize to the new citizens, as we call them, coming out of prison, that they are part of the community, they are valuable members of the community, and they have access to these community resources, just like anyone else. Third, the tone of delivery was also important. Remember I mentioned that the law enforcement message was first. It was deliberately not a message of, if you do this, we're going to get you. It was very straightforward, not preachy, and not scared straight. One way of thinking about the message is that it was simply, one of the AUSAs called it the steamroller. This is just my job, this is what I'm going to do, and if you make the bad choice, you'll you'll fall in the path of the steamroller. It's your job to stay out of that path, and we want you to stay out of that path. Everybody else, of course, was very encouraging to the participants and emphasized their agency. That is, they had a choice to obey the law or not. I think that's one of the key aspects of legitimacy, because if you think about why people obey the law, they don't obey the law because they fear the consequences of failing to do so. No, people obey the law either because they think it's the right thing to do or because they think that a particular governmental agent that they're dealing with or a particular law that's in question ought to be deferred to. And they do so for normative reasons, not for instrumental and deterrence-based reasons. That's not to say that deterrence is irrelevant, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in the Q&A. I think it is to say that the normative reasons are much more important, much more salient, and it's up to, I think, the reform-based law enforcement agents to harness that idea and shape policing strategies and laws in a way that conforms with our own normative priors about compliance. So I'll stop there, and we can start with questions.
I want to ask about New York City. Because we have had this plummeting violent crime rate in New York since 1991 or so. We have today fewer than 25% as many murders as we had some 18 years ago. The essential strategy of the New York police, and I don't attribute all of this, obviously, to police strategy, but the essential strategy of New York City police has been to get guns off the street. That is, if people possess guns, to make them leave them home. And it has done so in a number of ways. One was by making the sort of zero tolerance kinds of arrests, the jumping the turnstile kind of arrest, because the real point of zero tolerance was not that that itself deterred other forms of crime, but if you got arrested while you were carrying a gun for jumping a turnstile, you were going to go away to prison for a long time. And so that had an effect. Another part of the strategy has been to very much increase the use of stop and frisk, also with the idea of making people leave guns at home. An aspect of the strategy in New York, which seems unrelated to the stop and frisk character of it, is the New York City police make an enormous number of marijuana possession arrests, which means they do more than stop and frisk. They do actual searches to get the marijuana. And they wouldn't have to do that as part of the stop and frisk strategy, but that's one of the consequences of it. So you have this huge number of people being arrested for marijuana possession here in New York City. And the question is really, would it have been possible to drive down the homicide rate in New York City without these practices, which have, caused major disruptions to the lives of many of those affected, the marijuana arrests being an example, or the humiliation of the stops and frisks, or the arrests for the most petty kinds of offenses. Could it have been done in another way and have achieved the same kind of reduction in gun violence that we've had in New York?
I think so. I think the work in Chicago suggests that the answer to that is yes, because we drove down our homicide rate substantially and continue to drive it down without resorting, well, I shouldn't say without resorting, without it being attributable to that. And the reason why I say without resorting is because some of you may be familiar with Chicago's last police superintendent. We did attempt a New York style of policing. There were two different types of intensive police teams. One was called SOS, the Special Operational something. I can't even remember what SOS stands for. That was one. And the other had a different acronym. Both of them were referred to in the street as the Jump Out Boys. And basically, they would drive around Chicago, jump out, try to the stop and frisk to remove guns. My colleague, Dennis Rosenbaum, has shown that there's basically no relationship between that strategy, the implementation of that strategy, and the drop in homicide in Chicago. And our analysis, which is pretty heavy duty, some pretty heavy duty statistical kung fu, suggests that our strategy, the PSN strategy, was effective. Now, I won't say that what New York has been doing is hasn't had an impact. I think probably the policing strategy here has had an impact on crime. But, you know, echoing what you said, at what cost, it's pretty clear, right, that there is community dissatisfaction with the police. And I would say that we're living in a world here in New York in which police would not be considered legitimate along the lines that I normally think of that term. What makes policing legitimate? Well, three factors are pretty important. One indicia of legitimacy is that people are treated in ways in which they don't perceive bias in policing. That is, they don't perceive that they're being treated differently from other people. That's one. Two, that they perceive that they're being treated with dignity as people who count. And three, that they perceive that they can count on the benevolence of the law enforcement agent or the law. That one's harder to think about in the future. None of those three things, I think, are happening with the New York policing strategy. And those three things are the things that we tried to consciously incorporate into our strategy here. And I have, this is kind of a perfect question because it allows me to finish the rest of my PowerPoint, so I'll do that. The results that I showed you before were an attempt to assess how the strategies impacted aggregate crime levels over time. That is, we can see that the homicide rate is dropping. Can we see which parts of the strategy had an impact on that drop in crime? The next question people often ask is, okay, but what about the people who went to the forums? Are they different from the people who didn't go? And that's what this slide shows you. Basically, what you see is the people, the control people group, are the folks who didn't go to the forums. And you see that in the control group, about 56% of them reoffended, and about 44% didn't. But in the treatment group, about 90% did not reoffend, and 10% did. So those are pretty strong findings. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to emphasize the point. Here's not so great news, but still good. If we break the group down into people who are in gangs versus not, you see that we're still getting a treatment effect. The bad news for gang members is the majority of them are going back to prison, right? But even among gang members, the folks who went to the forums still are doing better than the folks who didn't. Now, the last thing I have to show you is a sort of graph that shows the difference. rather than talk about recidivism, we like to talk about desistance. You know, recidivism is on-off. Do you go to prison at the end of the day? Desistance is how long do you stay out on the street, right? So even if, especially with the gang members, you ultimately go back to prison, if you're staying out on the street longer, we consider that a very positive thing. You're still with your families, you're able to contribute to the community in some way, and we each month you stay out, there's another chance for intervention to keep you out on the street longer. So the gap you see in this graph between the treatment group and the control group is roughly the effect that we're getting from sending folks to the forum. And the way you understand that is if folks went to the forum, they're 33% more likely to stay out on the street longer. That's the way to interpret it. So I think, I hope, that that's one way of answering your question, you know, that we are driving down homicide rates in Chicago through another strategy. And I can also show you that the people who go to the forum are different from the people who didn't go. And I think they have a much better perception of law enforcement and the law. So it's something that I think we can work with.
Yeah, I want to say that it's very difficult to be persuasive on the trade-off argument, because if you take it from the standpoint of, let's say, the mayor of New York City, who is highly supportive of this stop and frisk strategy in New York, from his standpoint, the fact that New York has acquired a reputation as a safe city has been an enormous factor in tourism to the city. It has been an enormous factor in the regeneration of many neighborhoods in the city, and the fact that it's become desirable to move from the suburbs into the center of the city. From the mayor's standpoint, everything that is going well for the city depends on this drastic decline that has taken place in the violent crime rate. And so if you say that you've got an awful lot of people who are very unhappy because of the stops and frisks and so forth, that isn't enough from his standpoint to tilt the balance. So you really have to, in order to win the argument, I think one probably has to do two things. One has to show that another strategy is effective. And two, this is the most difficult part, that you have to show not only that the other strategy is effective, but that also he should not continue the strategy he's currently using. That is, his inclination would be to use them in combination if you prove that your strategy is effective. And therefore, getting him to stop doing this is immensely difficult.
Okay, so I would say you can't, right? They're mutually exclusive in important ways. And the reason why is it goes back to where Mark started with describing the difference between understanding why people break the law and understanding why people obey the law. Because that strategy, the strategy that you just described, is predicated only on an understanding that people will not break the law. I'm going to use it that way to keep my terms consistent. Not break the law when they fear the consequences of failing to do so. What New York does is get as many police out on the street as possible. Yeah, you have more police per capita than any place by far. One of the really interesting measures is not just police per capita, but police per capita per square mile. Jeff Fagan did a really interesting analysis, and New York City is saturated. It's crazy. So it's an idea that basically people out there are Pavlovian dogs, right? That if you know, if you're not ready there to beat them, then they're not. That's the only way they're gonna not break the law. The legitimacy strategy is different. It says that people can be encouraged to comply with the law for normative reasons, the same reasons that each one of you obeys the law. You don't obey the law because you think that a police officer standing on the street, well, maybe you do because you live in New York. But most of us don't, and we're taught at a very early age about the reasons why it's important to obey the law. And so what's important to do is simply have our law enforcement agents essentially continue that trend. To engage in strategies that are inconsistent with legitimacy, however, breaks that and is inconsistent with the normative compliance strategy. Moreover, I mean, we could say to the mayor, look, there is concrete evidence, not just the Chicago stuff, but years of social psychological data showing that these normative bases for compliance are actually tied up with compliance. There's a National Research Council book that I participated in writing called Fairness and Effectiveness in Policing. And there are two chapters on that where we're encouraging police executives to take this legitimacy strategy seriously. One other reason for doing it that the mayor might actually find appealing is that legitimacy strategies are cheap. It's simply about changing the way police do business. You know, it can be as simple as getting police officers to be more polite to people, whereas the strategy that New York is committed to, because it's based entirely on instrumental deterrence, requires a commitment to ever greater resources. For every percentage point that the mayor wants to drive the crime rate down here, according to that strategy, the mayor has to be committed to an infusion of more resources. Now, maybe in a world in which everybody was flush, that's okay. But in a world in which we're not flush, it's a problem. And one of the things I would be worried about here in New York is, to the extent that policing has begun to be perceived as illegitimate in certain sectors, if you don't have the money to continue the strategy that the city has been committed to, then it's very possible that there will be backlash.
So do you think you would be persuaded?
I can give him a different talk.
I think what would interest me immensely, and I don't know if any of your research deals with this, I think that this strategy that New York has pursued has had some part in the reduction in the violent crime rate. I don't think by any means it's the whole story. I think there were other factors as well. And what I'd be most interested in is if you saw anything which played the normative role that you are describing that also had a part in what took place here. My own feeling has been that one of the factors in New York is that the minority communities became quite strong in their criticism of crime and those who engaged in crime, and that they established part of the normative framework within which the people live who engaged in violent crime. And I think that was also a significant factor in what took place in New York. But that's my guess as someone who lives here in New York City and observes what's going on. I know of no research that investigates that or that documents that. But if one were able to show that through research, It seems to me that would be a powerful part of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you would have to have a pilot research project in New York, or look at these other communities.
Or
like
look at
Los
what
Angeles,
has happened
Chicago,
in particular neighborhoods where local institutions have had a particularly powerful effect. That is, you mentioned Jeff Canada. If you can show, for example, that in the neighborhood that Jeff has focused on, the Harlem Children's Zone, that there was a more significant drop in the violent crime rate than in other comparable neighborhoods, that would seem to me to be a significant finding, because I think Jeff has had a very significant normative role in the area where he works.
Johnny.
Oh, yeah.
The people who attended the forums were self-selecting, right?
No,
voluntary.
It was not voluntary.
Okay, so
that's
cancels my question.
That's why the design has such great internal validity.
Well, then a much more trivial question. I mean, Bogota in Colombia did something on fairly similar philosophical grounds a few years earlier. Was there any dialogue or connection?
I'll have to look that up. Nope. Our intellectual predecessors were mostly Boston, Boston ceasefire. That's it.
In terms of showing the positive effects of your work, you focused on the individuals and recidivism rates, but I guess it builds on Arie's question. What has been the change within Chicago PD culture, or even on the part of the USA's? Did Fitzgerald lessen his commitment to lengthening sentences, or?
So let me start with Pat. Pat's a really smart guy, and his view was that the lever that the U.S. Attorney's Office had to pull was federal prosecution for people who shouldn't have guns. It wasn't as if he was jumping up and down about doing it. His idea wasn't that we should be doing ever more prosecutions. It's that, you know, that was what he had to offer. So we had an early analysis in 2005 actually showing that getting guns off the street, this was before we had forum results, was the most important thing we could do, that federal prosecutions seemed to matter to a certain point, but that ever-increasing federal prosecutions probably didn't make a difference. Kind of in concert, I think, with this idea that if you're going to be committed to a deterrent strategy, it's going to keep costing you money, and there's probably going to be diminishing returns. And when we showed him that result, it was an interesting meeting because he came to the meeting late, and I was trying to explain to the ATF agent, the SAC, that we had this interesting finding with the federal prosecution. He's like, no, you're saying federal prosecution doesn't matter. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm saying, you know, we went back and forth. Pat looked at it. He was a stats major. And he said, oh, you're basically saying that we only have to do so many. Good. This is, you know, efficient. I like that. I can devote my resources elsewhere. So, you know.
And so have you seen a change in his office, though?
Well, I mean, I can count how many they have. And so his view is we only need to do so much to make this, you know, to make this effective, I think, to make the threat credible in the meetings. And, you know, they're off doing other things. I mean, he had a meeting with corporate funders actually just this week trying to garner support for an employment strategy that we want to try to append to PSN. But, you know, we don't have a lot of money. I mean, you know, the service component of this, you know, make no mistake, is not, you know, a fully funded
right.
it's simply giving these guys information about what's already out there. And so what we'd like to try to do is to provide more funding, and Pat's busy trying to raise money to do that. With respect to the police department, I mean, here's what I can say about that. We've been undergoing a lot of change recently. I don't know how many of you follow the Chicago Police Department, but we have a new police chief. He's been there for about a year. His name is Jody Weiss. He's a Fed, and he's never been a cop, let's put it that way. And so we've had an interesting time trying to marry the kinds of things he wants to do, which is to bring out the SWAT teams, with what the police commanders in these high-crime police districts want to do, which is be committed to ideas like PSN. And Chicago has a long history of community policing. The kinds of things that Aria was just talking about are things that, you know, there is plenty of research showing the ways in which different organizations play important roles in revitalizing different neighborhoods. I can tell you that I've had many police commanders around the table who now are committed to these ideas, that thinks that legitimacy is an important thing to be committed to. We have fewer hours in training than we've had before because of cutbacks, and so one of the hard tasks is trying to figure out where to find the space to train the new rookies appropriately in the midst of all the constitutional law that they think they have to know on the street. That part's been tough, but I know, I can say that at least the top brass think that this way of approaching things is the right way to do things. And they're not unique. I mean, the National Safety Network, we've had plenty of police chiefs sitting around the table who are willing to say that the way that we've done it in the past is a mistake, and we don't want to see anybody else going to prison anymore either. It's counterproductive. It's not helping. It's upending trust relations between the communities that we serve and you know, the people that we're trying to help, and we need to do it in a different way.
Can you speak to the strength of the model across different demographic settings? So if you took a very transient population where there isn't a strong sense of community, do you think the normative role would be as powerful?
I'm pausing because I'm having a little bit of trouble translating the question.
It seems to me that part of the legitimacy strategy is sort of uplifting the moral dimension of being part of a community and complying with normative standards. But if you had a very transient population, say, in parts of Baltimore where people are moving to and fro through different public housing setups or whatever, would the legitimacy strategy, do you think it would be as strong?
Yeah. And here's the reason why. Look, so now I'm going to go to theory land for a minute. The reason why the legitimacy strategy works is because it's based on theories of group value. And that is, basically, even if you're a transient population, there's some group that you have as a reference point, you know, to which you belong, whether it's your family or, you know, I'm African American, so I'm transient, but, you know, African Americans can be my reference group, or African American women, or whatever, right? And basically what people are constantly seeking is information about how they stand within their group, right? And you get that information in all sorts of ways. You get it from people in your group, but you also get it, importantly, in very public ways, like, let's say, the way the police treat you, mm-hmm. for example. So if you think that police are treating people from in your group differently from the way they treat people in Mark's group, then that's going to give you information about how your group is viewed in the eyes of that particular law enforcement agent and with respect to the law and government more generally. It also might give you information about how you rank specifically in your group right? So everything that I just said about dignity values and lack of bias values and trust values, all of those things, I'm looking for clues that help me sort of figure out information relevant to those factors that help me figure out where I stand. So everything is about how I perceive you as the government agent, how I perceive you treating me, how I perceive how you perceive me. And it's like a lot of things. But even if you don't really think that, right, you could hate me. Right? But if you treat me in a way that allows me to perceive that I think you think I count, then that's all that matters. And so I do think it's sometimes easier to do it with populations that might not be as transient, simply because there are sort of more opportunities for clues, right? But I don't think that it's impossible. It's just all about the reference point and advertising. I mean, one of the things that it says is about how law enforcement agencies can conduct themselves, right? If they make it plain that we're doing business in a different way. There are all sorts of ways you can do this. So in New Haven, for example, I actually have it on my computer. I've convinced the police department to use these little courtesy cards. And on one side of the card, it's the police officer side that says, you're entitled to get these things from the person that you're interacting with. And it's in English and Spanish. And on the other side is the, we call it the citizen side, and it says, you're entitled to get these things from the officer that you're encountering in English and Spanish. And the officer gives the card to the person if they stop them for either like a real crime stop or, you know, there's also lots of consensual encounters on the street. And it's not so much a script as it is an opportunity for the person and the officer to have dialogue about, you know, the engagement. And that's an important part of creating legitimacy, I think.
In the way that you describe the intervention, you put a significant emphasis on the forum.
Yeah.
But it sounds in this discussion that there, in addition to that one initial intervention, there is a there's some consistency of relationship that's either built that really drives this normative value that you're talking about. So am I right, or are you suggesting that it's that one-time intervention, or are there other changes in the way in which the police yeah. interacts with community, or that the service providers interact with the people who participated in the forum
yeah.
that actually is part of the dynamic yeah. that you're describing?
So let me start with what the data show, and then let me tell you what I think. The data suggest, almost unbelievably, but we have cut this stuff six ways to Sunday, that the forums matter, at least in terms of the impact of the different interventions on the dropping homicide rate, that the forums, and they matter the most, and the way we've measured it is how many people can we get through the door. One way of thinking about it is like being inoculated. It is only a one-time thing, right? So, when you get your vaccination, you only get one, and then, you know, it works. And hopefully you get enough people in your community, in your relevant community, who get vaccinated against any particular disease, and you get more of an effect. I kind of think that that's what's going on the west side of Chicago, because so many people who were actually eligible to go to the forum did. We had about 2,000 people go, in contrast to, which was about 80%. I'm going to just ignore this. I'm sorry. The south side location where I think it was more like 30 or 40% now. And we also know from looking at the recidivism that people who go to the forum are different. Now you're asking, well, what about the forum? I've placed a lot of emphasis on the message and the architecture of the forum and connecting it up with this legitimacy stuff. I can't tell you that the legitimacy strategy has permeated Chicago policing yet. It has not. I hope that it will, and if it does, there are all sorts of strategies that they should be engaging in and things doing differently that they don't necessarily do now. That is not, I don't know, and I can't tell you the answer to that because as a professor, first at the University of Chicago and now at Yale, I'm not actually allowed to talk to the people who go to the forum because of institutional review concerns. And I have tried mightily to get the parole officers to fill out a one-page sheet so I can just find out whether the attenders took up services and the like. And, you know, those guys are overworked and they haven't done it. So there's now a new guy on the team, and he's now tracking these people down. Maybe by this time next year I'll be able to tell you something. For now, I cannot tell you. So one of the things that I find pretty intriguing, though, is the possibility that it's not absolutely necessary, even though it would be very desirable, and we and more great results if we had a sustainment to service provision, because we now, and it would appear that we're getting some pretty important results.
I guess I'm not persuaded yet that what's really going on is some sense of legitimacy and normative value. The inoculation may in fact be sort of concentrated deterrence to some degree, or I mean, it just seems to me that one engagement seems to not be enough to shift sort of values and develop a sense of legitimacy if in fact it did not already exist.
Oh, so it definitely already exists. But here's where it already exists. I mean, if I can just interrupt you. Right? Look, it exists because that is the way we operate, right? We, meaning everybody, including offenders. I mean, so I have a new paper out that is titled Why Criminals Obey the Law, Intentionally Provocative, right? Criminals obey the law for the same reason that everybody else does. They just do. Most people obey the law most of the time. That's just the way it works, right? And so we've done some surveys now. I did get a little bit of money to do a survey of about 300 gun offenders in Chicago on parole and probation. I don't have those results to show you here, but we asked them all kinds of questions about their communities, where they get guns, how much they cost. We asked them the legitimacy questions. We asked them about different law enforcement strategies. Would you be less likely to carry a gun if you thought more police were out on the street, a la New York? Would you be more or less likely to carry a gun if you thought you would be subject to federal prosecution, so on and so forth? And one of the things that is really interesting about those survey results is, and we're the first to do this on a population of offenders. Most people who do this work do it on usually college psychology students or, you know, in better case scenario, Tom Tyler here in New York will actually survey general populations. We're the first people to do it on this kind of population, and the results are the same. They have the same commitment to compliance with the law, the same ideas about what is important to compliance with the law, these ideas of legitimacy, dignity, so on and so forth. The difference is that they have very low perceptions, typically, of the police. Prosecutors come out okay. Federal prosecutors, they have absolutely no opinion of, which it was beautiful when I gave those results to Pat. Like, see, they don't have any opinion of you. They don't care. On the one-time intervention thing, let me say two things on that. I think it's in part because their perceptions are so dismal of the police that it provides an opportunity when they are encountered in a context in which they're treated with respect and dignity, because it's so much of a surprise for them. I mean, you know, for people in this room probably, if you went to a meeting like that, he'd be like, well, yeah, you know, or if the police officer comes up to you and, you know, is polite to you, you're like, yeah, you know, you better be, you know, and if you don't, you're pretty upset. So it's actually a kind of, you know, because it's so bad, I think, it's a surprise, and there's some power in that. That's one hypothesis I have. Second, let me just tell you, small interventions can have very powerful effects. So a friend of mine who's a social psychologist, he used to be at Yale, now he's at the University of Colorado, he did an intervention with public school students in New Haven. The intervention was simply writing two paragraphs about what I did last summer, and what made me feel good, and something about, like, why am I a valuable person. It was a little essay, right? And, you know, he's a psychologist, so it had, you know, it was an extremely internally valid experiment. At the end of the year, the researchers looked at the kids' grades, all the kids in the class. The teacher didn't know who did the essay and who didn't. And at the end of the year, the kids who did the essay had grades that were statistically significantly higher than the kids who didn't. Now, a one little paragraph essay? Yes, this, I can actually give it to you. This study was published in Science magazine about 3 years ago, so it's pretty high profile. I think it's a suggestion that the study is worth something, and I guess that's one example I point to when people are skeptical. And finally, the other thing I want to say is, remember, these people are not going to these forums in isolation, right? They're going to the forums, they're going back to their communities, and groups of them are going together, you know, and they're interacting. That's what I mean about the inoculation. There's naturally a kind of social network aspect to this.
I agree very much with you this is Jim Guerrero from Washington. There's a real interest among people in Washington, policymakers, about what works. And I agree with you very much that small interventions can make a big difference. But how can we sell the research that's done on your program and others in Chicago? If you go through the research about violence interventions, a lot of it's Chicago-based. The nurse family partnerships goes back 30 years. There's a bunch of programs, but almost all of which are out of Chicago. Yet, you know, just last week, the paper was full of articles about how youth homicides are off the chart once again in Chicago. And it seems to the layperson that nothing has made much of a difference in Chicago, whereas at first glance or second glance or third glance, the approach that Aria was describing in New York has worked. In fact, the prison population has gone down dramatically in New York, something we all care about. So how can we sell that, that what people have been doing in Chicago has made some sort of difference?
Well, so Mark reminded us before we started that this was recorded and it was going to be very public. So one thing I will say about Chicago is that we were making really great strides in implementing the strategy, and then there was a transition. And transition issues are often very difficult. We're working through our transition right now. And we're very hopeful that there's going to be a renewed commitment to implementing the strategy in the way that it was implemented prior to the transition. But that has not been the case. So one thing I would do is just sort of encourage you to look at the trend line before the transition. And I think, you know, if we get back on track, I think... that we'll have something good to say. How can we sell it? Well, I think one way we can sell it is by joining with programs like I think you have it right. I call it the National Safety Network, but maybe that's not the right thing to call it. It's a collection of folks, the board of which Mark and I both sit. That are looking at strategies like the one in Chicago, like High Point, North Carolina, which we haven't talked about, which is slightly different, might be worth having a little bit of discussion about, like Boston Ceasefire. Each one of the strategies is a little bit different, but what they have in common is this commitment to direct moral engagement with the offenders in question, a commitment, I think, to a sort of more egalitarian structure rather than a hierarchical one, a commitment to including people in the affected communities and having them partner with law enforcement to figure out what is the best approach to address the problem that they're facing, whether it's violence or open-air drug markets, and also a commitment on the part of law enforcement agents to sort of to recognize past mistakes and, you know, adopt a sort of stance of humility, really. That, you know, one key to this is for police to fully embrace the fact that they are the agents of the community and not the other way around. I can tell Mark is anxious to say something, so let me just say one more sentence and turn it over. One of the things that I've done in my work, I've been doing this for 15 years, is to try to emphasize to people, especially people who are law enforcement skeptics, that in high crime communities, policing ought to be viewed as a resource for those communities, just like bright lighting and clean water and, you know, non-pothole filled streets. And the key then is to make sure that policing is presented to members of the relevant community in a way that allows them to access that resource, which requires police to understand the appropriate agency relationship.
I just wanted to add two things to that. First of all, if it were just Chicago, I think you could say maybe it's a fluke. But it's not just Chicago. I mean, I personally have spoken with police chiefs and community leaders in Providence, Rhode Island, in Hempstead, New York, in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it is not a fluke. If it were a fluke, I wouldn't be involved with it. So I think one way of selling it is to do what the National Network for Safe Communities is trying to do, which is to collate the experience of these now 75 different cities across the country that have implemented programs based on these principles, to show the research so that you see and when you do that, you see a consistent drop in gun crime or open-air drug market-related crime across these extraordinarily different cities facing different kinds of problems, but all using programs derived from these core principles. And the second thing is, when I first started looking at this about 3 years ago, I was also very, very skeptical that this one-time community meeting would have an effect. I just really doubted it. And it was only after having done two things, one, looking at the research, but second of all, talking to people who had been to them, people at risk for offending or offenders, and finding out what kind of an impact it had, because it was not a law enforcement, because it involved other aspects of the community, and because it was, as Tracy likes to phrase it, direct moral engagement. This is very clearly what we expect from you. These are the consequences if you go one way, and these are the good consequences if you go the other way. I think it has a quite remarkable effect along the lines of an intervention to an alcoholic. That's my thoughts on those two points. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had a couple quick questions around the youth violence aspect. And I was wondering if there was any disaggregated data around age groups around the offender notification meetings. And I did note that the gang members had a higher recidivism and were maybe not buying into the legitimacy. But I still wanted to know whether there was an age group, because we have 45-year-old, 50-year-old gang members. So that was one question, and the feedback you got, why that recidivism rate is so high. And then the other thought just seems to me, what do you think about this strategy working not on the intervention side but in a prevention side before individuals were offenders involved with the community collaboration, if there was any thought about that kind of strategy?
Yeah. So my data is only adults. They're old and older. I don't remember. I mean, we have done, if your question is, can I tell whether it works better on younger versus older people? Is that the question?
Yes.
We haven't done that analysis. The analysis that I showed you with those curves, with the graph, was holding age constant. We haven't specifically, you know, tried to cut it that way, but it's easy to do. I could. Why do I think that gang members recidivate are more likely to recidivate? They have much longer records. They're much more crime involved, and so, you know, they're easier for the police to find. They're more involved, and they have many more opportunities to make bad choices, and they do, sadly. But I would point out two things. One, I think it's important to try to get our minds off of recidivism and start thinking about desistance rather than recidivism. Because even though, yes, if you're looking at the end of the day of who ultimately goes back to prison, I mean, I showed that because that's the way people normally think about it. You know, I would like someday not to put that slide up anymore and to say, look, even my gang members are... Some of them are staying out longer, and the ones who are staying out longer are the ones who went to the forums. So it's mattering to them. A little bit ironically, I think because they're in parts of groups that have are very formalized and have strict rule structures, my survey data shows that members of gangs are much more likely to find the law legitimate than people who don't belong to gangs. It's not a surprise when you think about it, right? Because they actually are part of groups that think that following rules is important. And I think that's something that we can actually work with. As far as preventive, absolutely. And in fact, we have a BURN grant application in right now. BURN is the NIJ, National Institute of Justice, grant RFP that just went out. We have a grant in to do this with kids ages 15 to 17 in a more preventive strategy. Also, a person who should maybe be on your list, a guy named Frank Straub. He's the public safety commissioner at White Plains, New York. He's got a strategy, I think, that uses some of these principles called the Youth Police Initiative, which is all about trying to foster these positive relations before kids ever get involved in anything really negative. Now, the Youth Police Initiative is not, you know, like midnight basketball or, you know, police scout thing. I mean, it's really a concerted effort to both get the police to see what the world looks like from the kids' perspective, but also to get the kids to see what the world looks like from the police perspective. If I can just take one more minute, one of the interesting things they do is they have a mock dispatch where the police officers pretend that they're kids hanging out at the mall, and the kids are the police officers, and they show the kids how what happens when if a police car cruises by the mall, sees the kids, you know, those guys get out, another car goes by, they see cops out, so they stop as backup, and then the dispatch comes, and so the kids can actually understand how suddenly six police officers show up at a scene, and they think that the police are just sort of picking on them, but in reality, it's really about the way the dispatch process works. That's not to say that sometimes police officers don't pick on kids, but you know, once the kids kind of see how these things work, it's really eye-opening to them, and it's eye-opening for the officers on the other side of the room. Thank you.
Any other questions? You had a quick question on the treatment forums. Do they only include police and service providers and the re-entering inmates, or are there other members of the community there?
Right. So there are law enforcement representatives. I'm going to talk last. There are law enforcement representatives from Fed, state, local. There is the ex-offender who is, you know, the community representative. And there are the service providers who are also community representatives, because we take care to have service providers from the neighborhood in which offenders are reentering. There are no family members. There's nobody else there. We did that on purpose.
because the very first forums we had more sort of localized family type groups who wanted to speak, and those participants invariably would yell and scream at the offenders and would say, "You're the problem, not the solution." You know, they would just be very negative and not encouraging. And we want the stick message to be very dispassionate and straightforward. And we want the whole context to emphasize the agency of the participant to make a change, make the choice to make a change. And we felt that the family type more, you know, sort of ordinary, if you will, community members were impeding our ability to do that. Now, I will say that that's not necessarily the experience in other locations. So if you look at these meetings, if we'll call them call-ins, forums, whatever, in other places like in High Point and Milwaukee, those are the two I know most specifically, in Hempstead. In those places, the folks who participate are actually chosen to be people from the community that the offender knows and you know, that which the law enforcement team thinks will have some sway over that person. You know, has a sort of moral voice, can speak to that person in a way that will motivate that person to change their behavior. I've never actually attended one of those meetings myself, so I can't tell you what the tone is like. But to the extent that it's not the sort of encouraging, more dispassionate tone, I would be a little wary. On the other hand, you know, the results coming out of those places are very positive. Hempstead has a 90% reduction, I think, in its arrest rate. The public drug markets and High Point have completely shut down. I think there's also encouraging results in Cincinnati. I will say, though, now that I think about it, that both Hempstead and High Point were about closing down drug markets, in contrast to our work, which is much more about violence and guns. And so it might be that the populations are slightly different, and that might account for a tolerance in the difference in tone, maybe.
I'm not a true believer in restorative justice, but I know people who are, and they would point out that from a restorative standpoint, there are missing components. And I can understand your point that, like, a kind of public shaming might not actually be helpful. On the other hand, I just wondered if that was considered and tried.
Yeah.
Not the public shaming aspect of it, but the sense that in a restorative process, there might be some movement from public shaming to more encouraging messages.
But, you know, we think that the process is restorative, which is why it's set up in the way that it is, which is why the meetings are held where they are. To me, that's actually that in and of itself. It's architecturally restorative, right, that we're not going to have this meeting in the police station or in a courtroom. But if any of you have ever been to Chicago in one of our beautiful park buildings where there's a Chihuly exhibit, and we say, this is yours too, right, and you ought to avail yourself of this. This is part of you making the choice to make a change. You know, being spoken to in the way that they're spoken to. And I actually think there's a way in which the offender who speaks might be as meaningful, if not more meaningful, for those participants in that meeting as the family members who participate in the High Point Forum for the, you know, the former participants in the open-air drug market. Remember, in the High Point strategy, the only people who get to go to those forums are people who the team has decided deserves a second chance. They're not serious offenders, really, right? The more serious offenders are, by definition, prosecuted. They're never even in the room. My guys are the tough guys. I mean, you know, they're the guys with big time records. On average, the participants in my gun survey have been arrested 11 times.
Any other questions? I'll just take then to close this up. I will ask one other question, which Lenny asked me when we had coffee, and it's been touched on briefly already. But you know, this is an intervention which has a services component. These people come to this meeting, there's police, there's an ex-offender, and there's the community services. But there's, as you said, there is actually no money for these services. And yet, without money for these services, you have already seen a decline. What is or is not the role of providing services so that these ex-offenders have a better chance of being assimilated, for lack of a better word, into their communities?
Well, I mean, I guess you want to say two, maybe three things. We do have some money, not a lot. And that's why Pat's out there sort of beating bushes so to see if we can to get more money for services.
Thank you. I guess one of the things we want to say is, to the extent that we're more successful, we're going to be arresting fewer people, and there will be fewer people who will actually be in need of these services, so that maybe we have to raise less money and that there will be more slots available to the people who need them. So that's one important point. Two, on the importance of services, we get so far, right? But again, if we're measuring this in terms of desistance, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this. I think, I can show you how far we get in terms of desistance without providing any services, or very few, just sort of notifying people of available services. So one way of understanding this is, you can make an investment in further desistance by providing people with more of the services that they need, especially with respect to the gang population, which, is demonstrated to have some pretty durable problems, right? We're getting a lot of bang for our low services buck on the people who aren't gang members. So then maybe this says, here's a reason to make the hard case, which I know is hard for people to do, focus on this population and not the other population or less so. And I guess the final thing I want to say about this is sort of wrapping this up, going back to the legitimacy story, is one important thing to understand about this way of thinking, not so much the Chicago strategy per se, but the theoretical principles on which it's based. It's not necessarily, or not just, not only, not even primarily, frankly, in my opinion, about policing for the people who've been in prison, but it's really about policing for everybody else, right? Because if you try to constitute a law enforcement strategy, or, to be grand, your criminal justice system with why people obey the law in mind, rather than trying to think about, who's going to break the law, then you think about how to do all sorts of things fundamentally differently. And we are each other's best teachers, including teachers of the people on the graph that I showed you with respect to recidivism. So if you get it right, if you can convince the mamas of those boys that government is an entity that they can trust, that they can count on, that can help them to, help their kids make better choices, and you can do that consistently, then that's going to be your best way of making sure that crime rates stay low for the longest time.
On that note, I want to thank you very, very much for coming down here. It was excellent, and thank all of you for participating.